Rover. This is getting more and more wagon train every day. The resin sets almost instantly, but it gets stronger if you wait an hour, so I did. Then I suited up and headed out to the rover. I dragged the battery to the side of the rover and looped one end of the harness around it. Then I threw the other end over the roof. On the other side, I filled it with rocks. When the two weights were roughly equal, I was able to pull the rocks down and bring the battery up. Yay! I unplugged Rover 2's battery and plugged in Rover 1's. Then I went through the airlock to the rover and checked all systems. Everything was A-OK. I drove the rover around a bit to make sure the harness was secure. I found a few large-ish rocks to drive over, just to shake things up. The harness held. Hell yeah. For a short time, I wondered how to splice the second battery's leads into the main power supply. My conclusion was fuck it. There's no need to have a continuous power supply. When battery one runs out, I can get out, unplug battery one, and plug in battery two. Why not? It's a 10-minute EVA once per day. I'd have to swap batteries again when I'm recharging them, but again, so what? I spent the rest of the day sweeping off the solar cell farm. Soon, I shall be looting it. Log entry. Sol 65. The solar cells were a lot easier to manage than the battery. They're thin, light, and just lying around on the ground. And I had one additional bonus. I was the one who set them up in the first place. Well, okay, it wasn't just me. Vogel and I worked together on it. And boy, did we drill on it. We spent almost an entire week drilling on the solar array alone. Then we drilled more whenever they figured we had spare time. The array was mission critical. If we broke the cells or rendered them useless, the HAB wouldn't be able to make power, and the mission would end. You might wonder what the rest of the crew was doing while we assembled the array. They were setting up the HAB. Remember, everything in my glorious kingdom came here in boxes. We had to set it up on Sols 1 and 2. Each solar cell is on a lightweight lattice that holds it at a 14-degree angle. I'll admit I don't know why it's a 14-degree angle. Something about maximizing solar energy. Anyway, removing the cells was simple, and the HAB can spare them. With the reduced load of only supporting one human instead of six, a 14% energy production loss is irrelevant. Then it was time to stack them on the rover. I considered removing the rock sample container. It's nothing more than a large canvas bag attached to the roof, way too small to hold the solar cells. But after some thought, I left it there, figuring it would provide a good cushion. The cells stacked well. They were made to, for transport to Mars, and the two stacks sat nicely on the roof. They hung over the left and right edges, but I won't be going through any tunnels, so I don't care. With some more abuse of the emergency HAB material, I made straps and tied the cells down. The rover has external handles near the front and back. They're there to help us load rocks on the roof. They made perfect anchor points for the straps. I stood back and admired my work. Hey, I earned it. It wasn't even noon, and I was done. I came back to the HAB, had some lunch, and worked on my crops for the rest of the Sol. It's been 39 Sols since I planted the potatoes, which is about 40 Earth days, and it was time to reap and re-sow. They grew even better than I had expected. Mars has no insects, parasites, or blights to deal with, and the HAB maintains perfect growing temperature and moisture at all times. They were small compared to the taters you'd usually eat, but that's fine. All I wanted was enough to support growing new plants. I dug them up, being careful to leave their plants alive. Then I cut them up into small pieces with one eye each and reseeded them into new dirt. If they keep growing this well, I'll be able to last a good long time here. After all that physical labor, I deserved a break. I rifled through Johansson's computer today and found an endless supply of digital books. Looks like she's a big fan of Agatha Christie. The Beatles, Christie. I guess she's an Anglophile or something. I remember liking Hercule Poirot TV specials back when I was a kid. I'll start with The Mysterious Affair at Styles. Looks like that's the first one. Log entry. Sol 66. The time has come, ominous musical crescendo, for some missions. NASA gets to name their missions after gods and stuff, so why can't I? Henceforth, rover experimental missions will be serious missions. Get it? Dogs? Well, if you don't, fuck you. Sirius 1 will be tomorrow. The mission. Start with fully charged batteries and solar cells on the roof, drive until I run out of power, and see how far I get. I won't be an idiot. I'm not driving directly away from the HAB. I'll drive a half-kilometer stretch back and forth. I'll be within a short walk of home at all times. Tonight, I'll charge up both batteries so I can be ready for a little test drive tomorrow. I estimate 3.5 hours of driving, so I'll need to bring fresh CO2 filters. And with the heater off, I'll wear 3 layers of clothes. Log entry. Sol 67. Sirius 1 is complete. More accurately, Sirius 1 was aborted after 1 hour. I guess you could call it a failure, but I prefer the term learning experience. Things started out fine. I drove to a nice flat spot 1 kilometer from the HAB, then started going back and forth over a 500-meter stretch. I quickly realized this would be a crappy test. After a few laps, I had compressed the soil enough to have a solid path, nice, hard ground, which makes for abnormally high energy efficiency. Nothing like it would be on a long trip. So I shook it up a bit. I drove around randomly, making sure to stay within 1 kilometer of the HAB, a much more realistic test. After 1 hour, things started to get cold, and I mean really cold. The rover's always cold when you first get in it. When you haven't disabled the heater, it warms up right away. I expected it to be cold, but Jesus Christ! I was fine for a while. My own body heat plus 3 layers of clothing kept me warm, and the rover's insulation is top-notch. The heat that escaped my body just warmed up the interior, but there's no such thing as perfect insulation. And eventually, the heat left to the great outdoors while I got colder and colder. Within 1 hour, I was chattering and numb. Enough was enough. There's no way I could do a long trip like this. Turning the heater on, I drove straight back to the HAB. Once I got home, I sulked for a while. All my brilliant plans foiled by thermodynamics. Damn you, entropy! I'm in a bind. The damn heater will eat half my battery power every day. I could turn it down, I guess, be a little cold, but not freezing to death. Even then, I'd still lose at least 1/4. This will require some thought. I have to ask myself, what would Hercule Poirot do? I'll have to put my little gray cells to work on the problem. Log entry. Sol 68. Well, shit. I came up with a solution, but remember when I burned rocket fuel in the HAB? This'll be more dangerous. I'm going to use the RTG. The RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, is a big box of plutonium, but not the kind used in nuclear bombs. No, no. This plutonium is way more dangerous. Plutonium-238 is an incredibly unstable isotope. It's so radioactive that it will get red hot all by itself. As you can imagine, a material that can literally fry an egg with radiation is kind of dangerous. The RTG houses the plutonium, catches the radiation in the form of heat, and turns it into electricity. It's not a reactor. The radiation can't be increased or decreased. It's a purely natural process happening at the atomic level. As long ago as the 1960s, NASA began using RTGs to power unmanned probes. They have lots of advantages over solar power. They're not affected by storms. They work day or night. They're entirely internal, so you don't need delicate solar cells all over your probe. But they never used large RTGs on manned missions until the Ares program. Why not? It should be pretty damned obvious why not. They didn't want to put astronauts next to a glowing hot ball of radioactive death. I'm exaggerating a little. The plutonium is inside a bunch of pellets, each one sealed and insulated to prevent radiation leakage, even if the outer container is breached. So for the Ares program, they took the risk. An Ares mission is all about the MAV. It's the single most important component. It's one of the few systems that can't be replaced or worked around. It's the only component that causes a complete mission scrub if it's not working. Solar cells are great in the short term, and they're good for the long term if you have humans around to clean them, but the MAV sits alone for years, quietly making fuel, then just kind of hangs out until its crew arrives. Even doing nothing, it needs power, so NASA can monitor it remotely and run self-checks. The prospect of scrubbing a mission because a solar cell got dirty was unacceptable. They needed a more reliable source of power, so the MAV comes equipped with an RTG. It has 2.6 kilograms of plutonium-238, which makes almost 1,500 watts of heat. It can turn that into 100 watts of electricity. The MAV runs on that until the crew arrive. 100 watts isn't enough to keep the heater going, but I don't care about the electrical output. I want the heat. A 1,500-watt heater is so warm, I'll have to tear insulation out of the rover to keep it from getting too hot. As soon as the rovers were unstowed and activated, Commander Lewis had the joy of disposing of the RTG. She detached it from the MAV, drove 4 kilometers away, and buried it. However safe it may be, it's still a radioactive core, and NASA didn't want it too close to their astronauts. The mission parameters don't give a specific location to dump the RTG, just at least 4 kilometers away. So I'll have to find it. I have two things working for me. First, I was assembling solar panels with Vogel when Commander Lewis drove off, and I saw she headed due south. Also, she planted a 3-meter pole with a bright green flag over where she buried it. Green shows up extremely well against the Martian terrain. It's made to ward us off, in case we get lost on a rover EVA later on. So my plan is, head south 4 kilometers, then search around till I see the green flag. Having rendered Rover 1 unusable, I'll have to use my mutant rover for the trip. I can make a useful test mission of it. I'll see how well the battery harness holds up to a real journey, and how well the solar cells do strapped to the roof. I'll call it Sirius 2. Log entry. Sol 69. I'm no stranger to Mars. I've been here a long time. But I've never been out of sight of the HAB before today. You wouldn't think that would make a difference, but it does. As I made my way toward the RTG's burial site, it hit me. Mars is a barren wasteland, and I am completely alone here. I already knew that, of course, but there's a difference between knowing it and really experiencing it. All around me there was nothing but dust, rocks, and endless empty desert in all directions. The planet's famous red color is from iron oxide coating everything, so it's not just a desert. It's a desert so old it's literally rusting. The HAB is my only hint of civilization, and seeing it disappear made me way more uncomfortable than I like to admit. I put those thoughts behind me by concentrating on what was in front of me. I found the RTG right where it was supposed to be, 4 kilometers due south of the HAB. It wasn't hard to find. Commander Lewis had buried it atop a small hill. She probably wanted to make sure everyone could see the flag, and it worked great. Except instead of avoiding it, I beelined to it and dug it up. Not exactly what she was going for. It was a large cylinder with heat sinks all around it. I could feel the warmth it gave off even through my suit's gloves. That's really disconcerting, especially when you know the root cause of the heat is radiation. No point in putting it on the roof. My plan was to have it in the cabin anyway. So I brought it in with me, turned off the heater, then drove back to the HAB. In the 10 minutes it took to get home, even with the heater off, the interior of the rover became an uncomfortably hot 37 degrees Celsius. The RTG would definitely be able to keep me warm. The trip also proved that my rigging worked. The solar cells and extra battery stayed beautifully in place while traversing 8 kilometers of random terrain. I declare Sirius 2 to be a successful mission. I spent the rest of the day vandalizing the interior of the rover. The pressure compartment is made of carbon composite. Just inside that is insulation, which is covered by hard plastic. I used a sophisticated method to remove sections of plastic, hammer, then carefully removed the solid foam insulation, hammer again. After tearing out some insulation, I suited up and took the RTG outside. Soon, the rover cooled down again and I brought it back in. I watched as the temperature rose slowly, nowhere near as fast as it had on my trip back from the burial site. I cautiously removed more insulation, hammer, and checked again. After a few more cycles of this, I had enough insulation torn out that the RTG could barely keep up with it. In fact, it was a losing battle. Over time, heat will slowly leach out. That's fine. I can turn on the heater for short bursts when necessary. I brought the insulation pieces with me back into the HAB. Using advanced construction techniques, duct tape, I reassembled some of them into a square. I figure if things ever get really cold, I can tape that to a bare patch in the rover and the RTG will be winning the heat fight. Tomorrow, Sirius 3, which is just Sirius 1 again, but without freezing. Log entry, Sol 70. Today I write to you from the rover. I'm halfway through Sirius 3 and things are going well. I set out at first light and drove laps around the hab trying to stay on untouched ground. The first battery lasted just under 2 hours. After a quick EVA to switch the cables, I got back to driving. When all was said and done, I had driven 81 kilometers in 3 hours and 27 minutes. That's very good. Mind you, the land around the hab is really flat, as is all of Acidalia Planitia. I have no idea what my efficiency would be on the nastier land en route to Ares IV. The second battery still had a little juice left, but I can't just run it down all the way before I stop. Remember, I need life support while recharging. The CO2 gets absorbed through a chemical process, but if the fan that pushes it isn't working, I'll choke. The oxygen pump is also kind of important. After my drive, I set up the solar cells. It was hard work. Last time, I had Vogel's help. They aren't heavy, but they're awkward. After setting up half of them, I figured out I could drag them rather than carry them, and that sped things up. Now I'm just waiting for the batteries to recharge. I'm bored, so I'm updating the log. I have all the Poirot books and my computer. That'll help. It's going to take 12 hours to recharge, after all. What's that, you say? 12 hours is wrong? I said 13 hours earlier? Well, my friend, let me set you straight. The RTG is a generator. It's a paltry amount of power compared to what the rover consumes, but it's not nothing. It's 100 watts. It'll cut an hour off my total recharge time. Why not use it? I wonder what NASA would think about me fucking with the RTG like this. They'd probably hide under their desks and cuddle with their slide rules for comfort. Log entry, Sol 71. As predicted, it took 12 hours to charge the batteries to full. I came straight home as soon as they were done. Time to make plans for Sirius 4, and I think it'll be a multi-day field trip. Looks like power and battery recharging are solved. Food's not a problem. There's plenty of space to store things. Water's even easier than food. I need 2 liters per day to be comfortable. When I do my trip to Ares 4 for real, I'll need to bring the oxygenator. But it's big, and I don't want to screw with it right now, so I'll rely on O2 and CO2 filters for Sirius 4. CO2 isn't a problem. I started this grand adventure with 1,500 hours of CO2 filters, plus another 720 for emergency use. All systems use standard filters. Apollo 13 taught us important lessons. Since then, I've used 131 hours of filter on various EVAs. I have 2,089 left. 87 days worth. Plenty. Oxygen's a little trickier. The rover was designed to support 3 people for 2 days, plus some reserve for safety, so its O2 tanks can hold enough to last me 7 days. Not enough. Mars has almost no atmospheric pressure. The inside of the rover has 1 atmosphere, so the oxygen tanks are on the inside. Less pressure differential to deal with. Why does that matter? It means I can bring along other oxygen tanks and equalize them with the rover's tanks without having to do an EVA. So today, I detached one of the HAB's 2 25-liter liquid oxygen tanks and brought it into the rover. According to NASA, a human needs 588 liters of oxygen per day to live. Compressed liquid O2 is about 1,000 times as dense as gaseous O2 in a comfortable atmosphere. Long story short, with the HAB tank, I have enough O2 to last 49 days. That'll be plenty. Sirius 4 will be a 20-day trip. That may seem a bit long, but I have a specific goal in mind. Besides, my trip to Ares 4 will be at least 40 days. This is a good scale model. While I'm away, the HAB can take care of itself, but the potatoes are an issue. I'll saturate the ground with most of the water I have. Then I'll deactivate the atmospheric regulator so it doesn't pull water out of the air. It'll be humid as hell, and water will condense on every surface. That'll keep the potatoes well watered while I'm away. A bigger problem is CO2. The potatoes need to breathe. I know what you're thinking. Mark, old chap, you produce carbon dioxide. It's all part of the majestic circle of nature. The problem is, where will I put it? Sure, I exhale CO2 with every breath, but I don't have any way to store it. I could turn off the oxygenator and atmospheric regulator and just fill the hab with my breath over time, but CO2 is deadly to me. I need to release a bunch at once and run away. Remember the MAV fuel plant? It collects CO2 from the Martian atmosphere. A 10-liter tank of compressed liquid CO2 vented into the HAB will be enough CO2 to do the trick. That'll take less than a day to create. So that's everything. Once I vent the CO2 into the HAB, I'll turn off the atmospheric regulator and oxygenator, dump a ton of water on the crops, and head out. Sirius 4. A huge step forward in my rover research. And I can start tomorrow. Chapter 8. Hello, and thank you for joining us, Kathy Warner said to the camera. Today on CNN's Mark Watney Report, several EVAs over the past few days. What do they mean? What progress has NASA made on a rescue option, and how will this affect the Ares 4 preparations? Joining us today is Dr. Venkat Kapoor, Director of Mars Operations for NASA. Dr. Kapoor, thank you for coming.
A pleasure to be here, Kathy, Venkat said.
Dr. Kapoor, Kathy said, Mark Watney is the most watched man in the solar system, wouldn't you say?
Venkat nodded. Certainly the most watched by NASA. We have all 12 of our Martian satellites taking pictures whenever his sight's in view. The European Space Agency has both of theirs doing the same.
All told, how often do you get these images?
Every few minutes. Sometimes there's a gap based on the satellite orbits, but it's enough that we can track all his EVA activities.
Tell us about these latest EVAs.
Well, Venkat said, it looks like he's preparing Rover 2 for a long trip. On Sol 64, he took the battery from the other rover and attached it with a homemade sling. The next day, he detached 14 solar cells and stacked them on the rover's roof.
And then he took a little drive, didn't he? Kathy prompted.
Yes, he did. Sort of aimlessly for an hour, then back to the HAB. He was probably testing it. Next time we saw him was 2 days later, when he drove 4 kilometers away, then back. Another incremental test, we think. Then, over the past couple of days, he's been stocking it up with supplies.
Kathy said. Most analysts think Mark's only hope of rescue is to get to the Ares 4 site. Do you think he's come to the same conclusion?
Probably, Venkat said. He doesn't know we're watching. From his point of view, Ares 4 is his only hope.
Do you think he's planning to go soon? He seems to be getting ready for a trip.
I hope not, Venkat said. There's nothing at the site other than the MAV. None of the other pre-supplies. It would be a very long, very dangerous trip, and he'd be leaving the safety of the HAB behind.
Why would he risk it?
Communication, Venkat said. Once he reaches the MAV, he could contact us.
So that would be a good thing, wouldn't it?
Communication would be a great thing, but traversing 3,200 kilometers to Ares 4 is incredibly dangerous. We'd rather he stayed put. If we could talk to him, we'd certainly tell him that.
He can't stay put forever, right? Eventually he'll need to get to the MAV.
Not necessarily, Venkat said. JPL is experimenting with modifications to the MDV so it can make a brief overland flight after landing.
I'd heard that idea was rejected as being too dangerous, Kathy said.
Their first proposal was, yes. Since then, they've been working on safer ways to do it.
With only 3.5 years before Ares 4's scheduled launch, is there enough time to make and test modifications to the MDV?
I can't answer that for sure. But remember, we made a lunar lander from scratch in 7 years.
Excellent point, Kathy smiled. So what are his odds right now?
No idea, Venkat said. But we're going to do everything we can to bring him home alive.
Mindy glanced nervously around the conference room. She'd never felt so thoroughly outranked in her life. Dr. Venkat Kapoor, who was 4 levels of management above her, sat to her left. Next to him was Bruce Ng, the director of JPL. He'd flown all the way to Houston from Pasadena just for this meeting. Never one to let precious time go to waste, he typed furiously on his laptop. The dark bags under his eyes made Mindy wonder just how overworked he truly was. Mitch Henderson, the flight director for Ares III, swiveled back and forth in his chair, a wireless earpiece in his ear. It fed him a real-time stream of all the comm chatter from Mission Control. He wasn't on shift, but he was kept apprised at all times. Annie Montrose entered the conference room texting as she walked. Never taking her eyes off her phone, she deftly navigated around the edge of the room, avoiding people and chairs, and sat in her usual spot. Mindy felt a pang of envy as she watched the director of media relations. She was everything Mindy wanted to be. Confident, high-ranking, beautiful, and universally respected within NASA.
"How'd I do today?" Venkat asked.
"Eh," Annie said, putting her phone away. "You shouldn't say things like, 'bring him home alive.' It reminds people he might die."
"Think they're going to forget that?"
"You asked my opinion. Don't like it? Go fuck yourself."
"You're such a delicate flower, Annie. How do you end up NASA's director of media relations?"
"Beats the fuck out of me," Annie said.
"Guys," Bruce said, "I need to catch a flight back to L.A. in 3 hours. Is Teddy coming or what?"
"Quit bitching, Bruce," Annie said. "None of us want to be here." Mitch turned the volume down on his earpiece and faced Mindy.
"Who are you again?"
Mindy said. "I'm Mindy Park. I work in SATCON."
"You a director or something?"
"No, I just work in SATCON. I'm a nobody."
Venkat looked to Mitch. "I put her in charge of tracking Watney. She gets us the imagery."
"Huh," said Mitch. "Not the director of SATCON?"
"Bob's got more to deal with than just Mars. Mindy's handling all the Martian satellites and keeps them pointed at Mark."
"Why Mindy?" Mitch asked.
"She noticed he was alive in the first place."
"She gets a promotion 'cause she was in the hot seat when the imagery came through?"
"No," Venkat frowned. "She gets a promotion 'cause she figured out he was alive. Stop being a jerk, Mitch. You're making her feel bad."
Mitch raised his eyebrows.
"Didn't think of that. Sorry, Mindy."
Mindy looked at the table and managed to say, "'Kay." Teddy entered the room.
"Sorry I'm late."
He took his seat and pulled several folders from his briefcase. Stacking them neatly, he opened the top one and squared the pages within.
"Let's get started. Venkat, what's Watney's status?"
"Alive and well," Venkat said. "No change from my email earlier today."
"What about the RTG? Does the public know about that yet?"
Teddy asked. Annie leaned forward. "So far, so good," she said. "The images are public, but we have no obligation to tell them our analysis. Nobody has figured it out yet."
"Why did he dig it up?"
"Heat, I think," Venkat said. "He wants to make the rover do long trips. It uses a lot of energy keeping warm. The RTG can heat up the interior without soaking battery power. It's a good idea, really."
"How dangerous is it?" Teddy asked.
"As long as the container's intact, no danger at all. Even if it cracks open, he'll be okay if the pellets inside don't break. But if the pellets break too, he's a dead man."
"Let's hope that doesn't happen," Teddy said. "JPL, how are the MDV plans coming along?"
"We came up with a plan a long time ago," Bruce said. "You rejected it."
"Bruce," Teddy cautioned.
Bruce sighed. "The MDV wasn't made for liftoff and lateral flight. Packing more fuel in doesn't help. We need a bigger engine and don't have time to invent one, so we need to lighten the MDV. We have an idea for that. The MDV can be its normal weight on primary descent. If we made the heat shield and outer hull detachable, they could ditch a lot of weight after landing at Ares 3 and have a lighter ship for the traverse to Ares 4. We're running the numbers now."
"Keep me posted," Teddy said.
He turned to Mindy.
"Miss Park, welcome to the big leagues."
"Sir,"
Mindy said. She tried to ignore the lump in her throat.
"What's the biggest gap in coverage we have on Watney right now?"
Mindy said. "Once every 41 hours, we'll have a 17-minute gap. The orbits work out that way."
"You had an immediate answer," Teddy said. "Good. I like it when people are organized."
"Thank you, sir."
"I want that gap down to 4 minutes, Teddy said. "I'm giving you total authority over satellite trajectories and orbital adjustments. Make it happen."
"Yes, sir,"
Mindy said, with no idea how to do it. Teddy looked to Mitch.
"Mitch, your email said you had something urgent."
"Yeah," Mitch said. "How long are we going to keep this from the Ares 3 crew? They all think Watney's dead.
It's a huge drain on morale.
Teddy looked to Venkat.
Mitch, Venkat said, we discussed this.
No, you discussed it, Mitch interrupted.
They think they lost a crewmate. They're devastated.
And when they find out they abandoned a crewmate, Venkat asked, will they feel better then?
Mitch poked the table with his finger.
They deserve to know. You don't think Commander Lewis can't handle the truth?
It's a matter of morale, Venkat said. They can concentrate on getting home.
I make that call, Mitch said. I'm the one who decides what's best for the crew, and I say we bring them up to speed.
After a few moments of silence, all eyes turned to Teddy. He thought for a moment.
Sorry, Mitch, I'm with Venkat on this one, he said. But as soon as we come up with a plan for rescue, we can tell Hermes. There needs to be some hope, or there's no point in telling them.
Bullshit, Mitch grumbled, crossing his arms.
Total bullshit.
I know you're upset, Teddy said calmly. We'll make it right. Just as soon as we have some idea how to save Watney.
Teddy let a few seconds of quiet pass before moving on.
Okay, JPL's on the rescue option, he said with a nod toward Bruce. But it would be part of Ares IV. How does he stay alive till then? Venkat?
Venkat opened a folder and glanced at the paperwork inside. I had every team check and double-check the longevity of their systems. We're pretty sure the Hab can keep working for 4 years, especially with the human occupant fixing problems as they arise. But there's no way around the food issue. You'll start starving in a year. We have to send him supplies. Simple as that.
What about an Ares IV pre-supply? Teddy said. Landed at Ares III instead.
That's what we're thinking, yeah, Venkat confirmed. Problem is, the original plan was to launch pre-supplies a year from now. They're not ready yet. It takes 8 months to get a probe to Mars in the best of times. The positions of Earth and Mars right now, it's not the best of times. We figure we can get there in 9 months. Presuming he's rationing his food, he's got enough to last 350 more days. That means we need to build a pre-supply in 3 months. JPL hasn't even started yet.
That'll be tight, Bruce said. Making a pre-supply is a 6-month process. We're set up to pipeline a bunch of them at once, not to make one in a hurry.
Sorry, Bruce, Teddy said. I know we're asking a lot, but you have to find a way.
We'll find a way, Bruce said. But the OT alone will be a nightmare.
Get started, I'll find you the money.
There's also the booster, Venkat said. The only way to get a probe to Mars with the planets in their current positions is to spend a buttload of fuel. We only have one booster capable of doing that. The Delta 9 that's on the pad right now for the Eagle Eye 3 Saturn probe. We'll have to steal that. I talked to ULA and they just can't make another booster in time.
The Eagle Eye 3 team will be pissed, but okay, said Teddy. We can delay their mission if JPL gets the payload done in time.
Bruce rubbed his eyes.
We'll do our best.
He'll starve to death if you don't, Teddy said.
Venkat sipped his coffee and frowned at his computer. A month ago, it would have been unthinkable to drink coffee at 9 p.m. Now it was necessary fuel. Shift schedules, fund allocations, project juggling, out-and-out looting of other projects. He'd never pulled so many stunts in his life.
NASA's a large organization, he typed. It doesn't deal with sudden change well. The only reason we're getting away with it is the desperate circumstances. Everyone's pulling together to save Mark Watney with no interdepartmental squabbling. I can't tell you how rare that is. Even then, this is going to cost tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. The MDV modifications alone are an entire project that's being staffed up. Hopefully the public interest will make your job easier. We appreciate your continued support, Congressman, and hope you can sway the committee toward granting us the emergency funding we need.
He was interrupted by a knock at his door. Looking up, he saw Mindy. She wore sweats and a t-shirt, her hair in a sloppy ponytail. Fashion tended to suffer when work hours ran long.
Sorry to bother you, Mindy said.
No bother, Venkat said. I could use a break.
What's up? He's on the move, she said.
Venkat slouched in his chair.
Any chance it's a test drive?
She shook her head.
He drove straight away from the HAB for almost 2 hours, did a short EVA, then drove for another two. We think the EVA was to change batteries.
Venkat sighed heavily. Maybe it's just a longer test, an overnight trip kind of thing.
He's 76 kilometers from the HAB, Mindy said. For an overnight test, wouldn't he stay within walking distance?
Yes, he would, Venkat said. Damn it. We've had teams run every conceivable scenario. There's just no way he can make it to Ares IV with that setup. We never saw him load up the oxygenator or water reclaimer. He can't possibly have enough basics to live long enough.
I don't think he's going to Ares IV, Mindy said. If he is, he's taking a weird path.
Oh? Said Venkat.
He went south-southwest. Schiaparelli Crater is southeast.
Okay, maybe there's hope, Venkat said. What's he doing right now?
Recharging. He's got all the solar cells set up, Mindy said. Last time he did that, it took 12 hours. I was going to sneak home for some sleep, if that's okay.
Sure, sounds good. We'll see what he does tomorrow. Maybe he'll go back to the HAB.
Maybe,
Mindy said, unconvinced.
Welcome back, Kathy said to the camera. We're chatting with Marcus Washington from the U.S. Postal Service. So, Mr. Washington, I understand the Ares III mission caused a postal service first. Can you explain that to our viewers?
Yeah, said Marcus. Everyone thought Mark Watney was dead for over 2 months. In that time, the Postal Service issued a run of commemorative stamps honoring his memory. 20,000 were printed and sent to post offices around the country.
And then it turned out he was alive, Kathy said.
Yeah, said Marcus. We don't print stamps of living people. So we stopped the run immediately and recalled the stamps, but thousands were already sold.
Has this ever happened before? Kathy asked.
No, not once in the history of the Postal Service.
I bet they're worth a pretty penny now.
Marcus chuckled. Maybe. But like I said, thousands were sold. They'll be rare, but not super rare.
Kathy chuckled, then addressed the camera.
We've been speaking with Marcus Washington of the United States Postal Service. If you've got a Mark Watney commemorative stamp, you might want to hold on to it. Thanks for dropping by, Mr. Washington.
Thanks for having me, Marcus said.
Our next guest is Dr. Irene Shields, flight psychologist for the Ares missions. Dr. Shields, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Irene said, adjusting her microphone clip.
Do you know Mark Watney personally?
Of course, Irene said. I did monthly psych evaluations on each member of the crew.
What can you tell us about him? His personality, his mindset?
Well, Irene said, he's very intelligent. All of them are, of course. But he's particularly resourceful and a good problem solver.
That may save his life, Kathy interjected.
It may indeed, Irene agreed. Also, he's a good-natured man, usually cheerful, with a great sense of humor. He's quick with a joke. In the months leading up to launch, the crew was put through a grueling training schedule. They all showed signs of stress and moodiness. Mark was no exception, but the way he showed it was to crack more jokes and get everyone laughing.
He sounds like a great guy, Kathy said.
He really is, Irene said. He was chosen for the mission in part because of his personality. An Ares crew has to spend 13 months together. Social compatibility is key. Mark not only fits well in any social group, he's a catalyst to make the group work better. It was a terrible blow to the crew when he died.
And they still think he's dead, right? The Ares III crew?
Yes, they do, unfortunately, Irene confirmed. The higher-ups decided to keep it from them, at least for now. I'm sure it wasn't an easy decision.
Kathy paused for a moment, then said, All right, you know I have to ask. What's going through his head right now? How does a man like Mark Watney respond to a situation like this? Stranded, alone, no idea we're here to help.
There's no way to be sure, Irene said. The biggest threat is giving up hope. If he decides there's no chance to survive, he'll stop trying.
Then we're okay for now, right? Kathy said. He seems to be working hard. He's prepping the rover for a long trip and testing it. He plans to be there when Ares IV lands.
That's one interpretation, yes, Irene said. Is there another?
Irene carefully formed her answer before speaking.
When facing death, people want to be heard. They don't want to die alone. He might just want the MAV radio so he can talk to another soul before he dies. If he's lost hope, he won't care about survival. His only concern will be making it to the radio. After that, he'll probably take an easier way out than starvation. The medical supplies of an Ares mission have enough morphine to be lethal.
After several seconds of complete silence in the studio, Kathy turned to the camera.
We'll be right back.
Hiya, Venk, Bruce's voice came from the speakerphone on Venkit's desk. Bruce, hi, said Venkit, typing on his computer. Thanks for clearing up some time. I wanted to talk about the pre-supply.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Let's say we soft-landed perfectly. How will Mark know it happened? And how will he know where to look?
We've been thinking about that, said Bruce. We've got some ideas.
I'm all ears, Venkit said, saving his document and closing his laptop.
We'll be sending him a comm system anyway, right? We could have it turn on after landing. It'll broadcast on the rover and EVA suit frequencies. It'll have to be a strong signal, too. The rovers were only designed to communicate with the HAB and each other. The signal origin was presumed to be within 20 kilometers. The receivers just aren't very sensitive. The EVA suits are even worse. But as long as we have a strong signal, we should be good. Once we land the pre-supply, we'll get its exact location from satellites, then broadcast that to Mark so he can go get it.
But he's probably not listening, said Venkit. Why would he be?
We have a plan for that. We're going to make a bunch of bright green ribbons, light enough to flutter around when dropped, even in Mars's atmosphere. Each ribbon will have Mark, turn on your comm printed on it. We're working on a release mechanism now, during the landing sequence, of course, ideally about 1,000 meters above the surface.
I like it, Venkit said. All he needs to do is note as one, and he's sure to check out a bright green ribbon if he sees one outside.
Venk, said Bruce, if he takes the Watney Mobile to Ares IV, this'll all be for nothing. I mean, we can land it at Ares IV if that happens, but...
But he'll be without a HAB.
Yeah, Venkit said.
One thing at a time. Let me know when you come up with a release mechanism for those ribbons.
Will do.
After terminating the call, Venkit opened his laptop to get back to work. There was an email from Mindy Park waiting for him. Watney's on the move again.
Still going in a straight line, Mindy said, pointing to her monitor.
I see, Venkit said. He's sure as hell not going to Ares IV, unless he's going around some natural obstacle.
There's nothing for him to go around, Mindy said. It's Acidalia Planitia.
Are those the solar cells? Venkit asked, pointing to the screen.
Yeah, Mindy said. He did the usual 2-hour drive, EVA 2-hour drive. He's 156 kilometers from the HAB now.
They both peered at the screen.
Wait, Venkit said. Wait, no way.
What? Mindy asked.
Venkit grabbed a pad of post-its and a pen.
Give me his location and the location of the HAB.
Mindy checked her screen.
He's currently at 28.9 degrees north, 29.6 degrees west.
With a few keystrokes, she brought up another file.
The HAB's at 31.2 degrees north, 28.5 degrees west. What do you see?
Venkit finished taking down the numbers.
Come with me, he said, quickly walking out.
Mindy stammered, following after.
Where are we going?
Satcon break room, Venkit said. You guys still have that map of Mars on the wall?
Sure, Mindy said, but it's just a poster from the gift shop. I've got high-quality digital maps on my computer.
Nope, I can't draw on those, he said.
Then, rounding the corner to the break room, he pointed to the Mars map on the wall.
I can draw on that.
The break room was empty, save for a computer technician sipping a cup of coffee. He looked up in alarm as Venkit and Mindy stormed in.
Good. It has latitude and longitude lines, Venkit said.
Looking at his post-it, then sliding his finger along the map, he drew an X.
"That's the hab," he said.
"Hey," the technician said. "Are you drawing on our poster?"
"I'll buy you a new one," Venkat said without looking back.
Then he drew another X.
"That's his current location. Get me a ruler."
Mindy looked left and right. Seeing no ruler, she grabbed the technician's notebook.
"Hey!"
the technician protested. Using the notebook as a straight edge, Venkat drew a line from the hab to Mark's location and beyond, then took a step back.
"Yep, that's where he's going," Venkat said excitedly.
"Oh," Mindy said. The line passed through the exact center of a bright yellow dot printed on the map. "Pathfinder," Mindy said. "He's going to Pathfinder."
"Yep," Venkat said. "Now we're getting somewhere. It's like 800 kilometers from him. He can get there and back with supplies on hand."
"And bring Pathfinder and Sojourner Rover back with him," Mindy added. Venkat pulled out his cell phone.
"We lost contact with Pathfinder in 1997. If he can get it online again, we can communicate. It might just need the solar cells cleaned. Even if it's got a bigger problem, he's an engineer."
Dialing, he added, "Fixing things is his job." Smiling for what felt like the first time in weeks, he held the phone to his ear and awaited a response.
"Bruce, it's Venkat. Everything just changed. Watney's headed for Pathfinder."
"Yeah, I know, right? Dig up everyone who was on that project and get them to JPL now. I'll catch the next flight."
Hanging up, he grinned at the map.
"Mark, you sneaky, clever son of a bitch."
Chapter 9. Log Entry. Sol 79. It's the evening of my 8th day on the road. Series 4 has been a success so far. I've fallen into a routine. Every morning I wake up at dawn. First thing I do is check oxygen and CO2 levels. Then I eat a breakfast pack and drink a cup of water. After that, I brush my teeth using as little water as possible and shave with an electric razor. The rover has no toilet. We were expected to use our suit's reclamation systems for that, but they aren't designed to hold 20 days' worth of output. My morning piss goes in a resealable plastic box. When I open it, the rover reeks like a truck stop men's room. I could take it outside and let it boil off, but I worked hard to make that water, and the last thing I'm going to do is waste it. I'll feed it to the water reclaimer when I get back. Even more precious is my manure. It's critical to the potato farm, and I'm the only source on Mars. Fortunately, when you spend a lot of time in space, you learn how to shit in a bag. And if you think things are bad after opening the piss box, imagine the smell after I drop anchor. After I'm done with that lovely routine, I go outside and collect the solar cells. Why didn't I do it the previous night? Because trying to dismantle and stack solar cells in total darkness isn't fun. I learned that the hard way. After securing the cells, I come back in, turn on some shitty 70s music, and start driving. I putter along at 25 kilometers per hour, the rover's top speed. It's comfortable inside. I wear hastily made cutoffs and a thin shirt while the RTG bakes the interior. When it gets too hot, I detach the insulation duct tape to the hull. When it gets too cold, I tape it back up. I can go almost 2 hours before the first battery runs out. I do a quick EVA to swap cables, then I'm back at the wheel for the second half of the day's drive. The terrain is very flat. The undercarriage of the rover is taller than any of the rocks around here, and the hills are gently sloping affairs, smoothed by eons of sandstorms. When the other battery runs out, it's time for another EVA. I pull the solar cells off the roof and lay them on the ground. For the first few sols, I lined them up in a row. Now I plop them wherever, trying to keep them close to the rover out of sheer laziness. Then comes the incredibly dull part of my day. I sit around for 12 hours with nothing to do, and I'm getting sick of this rover. The inside's the size of a van. That may seem like plenty of room, but try being trapped in a van for 8 days. I look forward to tending my potato farm in the wide open space of the hab. I'm nostalgic for the hab. How fucked up is that? I have shitty 70s TV to watch and a bunch of Poirot novels to read, but mostly I spend my time thinking about getting to Ares 4. I'll have to do it someday. How the hell am I going to survive a 3,200-kilometer trip in this thing?
It'll probably take 50 days. I'll need the water reclaimer and the oxygenator, maybe some of the HAB's main batteries, then a bunch more solar cells to charge everything. Where will I put it all? These thoughts pester me throughout the long, boring days. Eventually, it gets dark and I get tired. I lie among the food packs, water tanks, extra O2 tank, piles of CO2 filters, box of pee, bags of shit, and personal items. I have a bunch of crew jumpsuits to serve as bedding, along with my blanket and pillow. Basically, I sleep in a pile of junk every night. Speaking of sleep, good night. Log entry. Sol 80. By my reckoning, I'm about 100 kilometers from Pathfinder. Technically, it's Carl Sagan Memorial Station, but with all due respect to Carl, I can call it whatever the hell I want. I'm the King of Mars. As I mentioned, it's been a long, boring drive, and I'm still on the outward leg. But hey, I'm an astronaut. Long-ass trips are my business. Navigation is tricky. The HAB's nav beacon only reaches 40 kilometers, so it's useless to me out here. I knew that'd be an issue when I was planning this little road trip, so I came up with a brilliant plan that didn't work. The computer has detailed maps, so I figured I could navigate by landmarks. I was wrong. Turns out you can't navigate by landmarks if you can't find any goddamned landmarks. Our landing site is at the delta of a long-gone river. NASA chose it because if there are any microscopic fossils to be had, it's a good place to look. Also, the water would have dragged rock and soil samples from thousands of kilometers away. With some digging, we could get a broad geological history. That's great for science, but it means the HAB's in a featureless wasteland. I considered making a compass. The rover has plenty of electricity, and the med kit has a needle. Only one problem. Mars doesn't have a magnetic field. So I navigate by Phobos. It whips around Mars so fast it actually rises and sets twice a day, running west to east. It isn't the most accurate system, but it works. Things got easier on Sol 75. I reached a valley with a rise to the west. It had flat ground for easy driving, and I just needed to follow the edge of the hills. I named it Lewis Valley, after our fearless leader. She'd love it there, geology nerd that she is. 3 sols later, Lewis Valley opened into a wide plain, so again, I was left without references and relied on Phobos to guide me. There's probably symbolism there. Phobos is the god of fear, and I'm letting it be my guide. Not a good sign. But today, my luck finally changed. After 2 sols wandering the desert, I found something to navigate by. It was a 5-kilometer crater, so small it didn't even have a listed name, but it was on the maps, so to me it was the lighthouse of Alexandria. Once I had it in sight, I knew exactly where I was. I'm camped near it now, as a matter of fact. I'm finally through the blank areas of the map. Tomorrow I'll have the lighthouse to navigate by and Hamelin Crater later on. I'm in good shape. Now, on to my next task. Sitting around with nothing to do for 12 hours. I better get started. Log entry. Sol 81. Almost made it to Pathfinder today, but I ran out of juice. Just another 22 kilometers to go. An unremarkable drive. Navigation wasn't a problem. As the lighthouse receded into the distance, the rim of Hamelin Crater came into view. I left Acidalia Planitia behind a long time ago. I'm well into Ares Vallis now. The desert plains are giving way to bumpier terrain, strewn with ejecta that never got buried by sand. It makes driving a chore. I have to pay more attention. Up till now, I've been driving right over the rock-strewn landscape, but as I travel farther south, the rocks are getting bigger and more plentiful. I have to go around some of them or risk damage to my suspension. The good news is I don't have to do it for long. Once I get to Pathfinder, I can turn around and go the other way. The weather's been very good. No discernible wind, no storms. I think I got lucky there. There's a good chance my rover tracks from the past few sols are intact. I should be able to get back to Lewis Valley just by following them. After setting up the solar panels today, I went for a little walk. I never left sight of the rover. The last thing I want to do is get lost on foot. But I couldn't stomach crawling back into that cramped, smelly rat's nest. Not right away. It's a strange feeling. Everywhere I go, I'm the first. Step outside the rover,
First guy ever to be there. Climb a hill? First guy to climb that hill. Kick a rock? That rock hadn't moved in a million years. I'm the first guy to drive long distance on Mars. The first guy to spend more than 31 sols on Mars. The first guy to grow crops on Mars. First, first, first. I wasn't expecting to be first at anything. I was the fifth crewman out of the MDV when we landed, making me the 17th person to set foot on Mars. The egress order had been determined years earlier. A month before launch, we all got tattoos of our Mars numbers. Johansson almost refused to get her 15 because she was afraid it would hurt. Here's a woman who had survived the centrifuge, the vomit comet, hard landing drills, and 10K runs. A woman who fixed a simulated MDV computer failure while being spun around upside down. But she was afraid of a tattoo needle. Man, I miss those guys. Jesus Christ, I'd give anything for a 5-minute conversation with anyone. Anyone, anywhere, about anything. I'm the first person to be alone on an entire planet. Okay, enough moping. I am having a conversation with someone, whoever reads this log. It's a bit one-sided, but it'll have to do. I might die, but damn it, someone will know what I had to say. And the whole point of this trip is to get a radio. I could be reconnected with mankind before I even die. So here's another first. Tomorrow, I'll be the first person to recover a Mars probe. Log entry. Sol 82. Victory! I found it. I knew I was in the right area when I spotted Twin Peaks in the distance. The two small hills are under a kilometer from the landing site. Even better, they were on the far side of the site. All I had to do was aim for them until I found the lander. And there it was, right where it was supposed to be. I excitedly stumbled out and rushed to the site. Pathfinder's final stage of descent was a balloon-covered tetrahedron. The balloons absorbed the impact of landing. Once it came to rest, they deflated, and the tetrahedron unfolded to reveal the probe. It's actually two separate components, the lander itself and the Sojourner rover. The lander was immobile, while Sojourner wandered around and got a good look at the local rocks. I'm taking both back with me, but the important part is the lander. That's the part that can communicate with Earth. I can't explain how happy I was to find it. It was a lot of work to get here, and I'd succeeded. The lander was half buried. With some quick and careful digging, I exposed the bulk of it, though the large tetrahedron and the deflated balloons still lurked below the surface. After a quick search, I found Sojourner. The little fellow was only 2 meters from the lander. I vaguely remember it was farther away when they last saw it. It probably entered a contingency mode and started circling the lander, trying to communicate. I quickly deposited Sojourner in my rover. It's small, light, and easily fit in the airlock. The lander was a different story. I had no hope of getting the whole thing back to the HAB. It was just too big, but I only needed the probe itself. It was time for me to put on my mechanical engineer hat. The probe was on the central panel of the unfolded tetrahedron. The other three sides were each attached to the central panel with a metal hinge. As anyone at JPL will tell you, probes are delicate things. Weight is a serious concern, so they're not made to stand up to much punishment. When I took a crowbar to the hinges, they popped right off. Then things got difficult. When I tried to lift the central panel assembly, it didn't budge. Just like the other three panels, the central panel had deflated balloons underneath it. Over the decades, the balloons had ripped and filled with sand. I could cut off the balloons, but I'd have to dig to get to them. It wouldn't be hard, it's just sand. But the other three panels were in the damn way. I quickly realized I didn't give a crap about the condition of the other panels. I went back to my rover, cut some strips of HAB material, then braided them into a primitive but strong rope. I can't take credit for it being strong. Thank NASA for that. I just made it rope-shaped. I tied one end to a panel and the other to the rover. The rover was made for traversing extremely rugged terrain, often at steep angles. It may not be fast, but it has great torque. I towed the panel away like a redneck removing a tree stump. Now I had a place to dig. As I exposed each balloon, I cut it off. The whole task took an hour. Then I hoisted the central panel assembly up and carried it confidently to the rover. At least that's what I wanted to do. The damn thing is still heavy as hell. I'm guessing it's 200 kilograms. Even in Mars's gravity, that's a bit much. I could carry it around the HAB easily enough, but lifting it while wearing an awkward EVA suit, out of the question. So I dragged it to the rover. Now for my next feat, getting it on the roof. The roof was empty at the moment,